content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benroot from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, a team of volunteer readers will be reading short science fiction stories. We call our program Science Fiction Shorts, and it will be available in podcast after the broadcast.
I'm Steve Lord, and I'll be reading Inalienable Rights by Mary E. Loud. Roscoe's long ears would not stand tall, no matter how he strained to hold them up. His reflection in the empty viewscreen looked haggard and scared, but he'd stared at it for long enough trying to compose himself. He would never be composed. He had to proceed anyway. With a nervous twitch of his nose, Roscoe opened a communication channel to the planet below, and moments later, a familiar face filled the viewscreen. His cousin, Chilchi. Her ears stood tall. "Roscoe, we thought we'd never see you again. It's been 3 years." Roscoe's nerves calmed a little at the warm sight of his cousin. "Can you put me through to the Royal High Cajon?" "Of course," Chilchi said, suddenly all business. Roscoe felt bad rebuffing her like that, but he had to do the hard part of this first. There would be time to catch up later, if he could get through the hard part, if he could stand up to the High Royal. Chilchi's fuzzy, round, lapine face disappeared from the screen and was replaced by the long, narrow face of the High Royal Cajon. Her fur was as fine and pale as dandelion down, and her primatoid features were pinched and creased. Her black eyes burned like the void. "You are dead to me, runaway bunny!" The High Royal Cajon spat the words as if it was beneath her to speak to a former slave at all. "I am free from you," Roscoe corrected, finding his voice in spite of his nerves. He had feared this day for years, and yet the Cajon wasn't nearly so scary to behold as he remembered. She was twice his height, he remembered, but on the screen she looked small. He had bested her once before, escaping into the crowds on Crossroads Station to become a free lapine. Now he would best her again. "I've come back to free my family," Roscoe said, ears straightening proudly above him. He transmitted a list down to the surface, containing every extended family member and friend he'd ever had. 100-some uplifted lapine slaves in all. The High Royal Cajon frowned as she read the transmission. "This is every one of my servants, many of my compatriot servants, and some servants that have been traded into different keeps during the last several years. I'll also need the spouses and children of anyone on that list," Roscoe added. "You can't seriously expect me to hand this many uplifted lapines over. Even if you could afford them, as a runaway, you have no standing for purchasing them. Furthermore, my keep couldn't handle this level of upheaval. I could never part with this many well-trained servants for any price." Roscoe's ears didn't waver as he said, "I'm not buying them." He'd already spent all of the money he'd saved during the last 3 years to rent this starship, a vessel large enough to ferry all of them back to Crossroads Station. "I'm offering free transport to them. On their behalf, I turn you down." "I don't recommend that." Roscoe's fuzzy face had never looked less cute. He was a lapine ready to fight. He would give no quarter to this primatoid who had owned the first half of his life. Enslavement of sentient beings, evolved, uplifted, manufactured, or otherwise, is a crime of the first order in the Western Spiral Arm Treaty Alliance. The High Royal Cajon's ears were too small to splay, but the look in her black eyes was priceless. She was cornered, and she knew it. "You knew about that law," Roscoe said, piecing together what had happened 3 years ago after he'd run away from her. "That's why you went home without joining the Alliance, because you learned about that law. And you decided you'd rather keep my people enslaved."
"We uplifted you," the Cajon shrieked.
You were feral rabbits until we tweaked your genes, changing you over generations." Her long-fingered hands balled into fists, and her black eyes flashed like stars collapsing. "It was painstaking work, hard work. You owe us. You belong to us." "Not according to interstellar law." Roscoe could see the Cajon weighing her options. He only had one ship. He couldn't back up his claim. But if he'd registered his plans with Crossroads Station, then someone might come looking for him if he didn't return. If they came looking for him. No, she had to keep her planet hidden to preserve her way of life. If she sent him on his way without what he wanted, he could report a massive sentience rights violation. If she gave him what he wanted, it might buy her species a few more years before their entire way of life was overturned. "You are an ungrateful creature, and we should never have uplifted your kind," the Cajon said. Then her sour primatoid face disappeared. A moment later, Chulchi reappeared on the viewscreen, looking bewildered but happy. "I'm told that I have some arrangements to make for you." Roscoe's ears couldn't stand any taller as he said, "Let me tell you about where I've been living. It's an interstellar hub called Crossroads Station, and I think you'll like it there."
My name is Joanna LaForgia, and I'll be reading Your New Voice and You by Renee Sears. You watch the mermaids swim. Sometimes you think of joining them. They're like parrotfish, bright and pretty. If you joined them, they would scatter like a school of fish when a predator comes along. So you do nothing but watch from the shadows. From there, sometimes you see ships and shipwrecks and sailors. They you are less tempted to join. They only come to you when they want something. Mermaids looking for feet. Sailors looking for a knotted rope to capture wind. It's all the same. They fear what you are as much as long for what you can do. If they see you outside of your lair, when they haven't come to you, they flee or stuff their ears with wax. You are not meant to approach, only be approached. Sometimes children come to you on a dare, tails flashing in the sunlight. They come to the edge of the shadows and toss things into your lair, conch shells, bits of coral, dead fish sometimes. Anything to make themselves feel brave at defying the sea witch. You have only to show yourself, black hair streaming like squid ink, dark coiling tail in the mouth of your cave, and they flee. Only once did one linger. She was bright as the shallows, a slip of a thing, and she watched you with some emotion you could not name plain on her face. It wasn't fear, and that made her different. She reached a hand to you, and before you could stop yourself, you reached a hand back. Her sisters called her name from the sunlit water, and she fled like the rest of them. You don't know what you would have done if she had touched you anyway. Mermaid or sea witch, siren or hag, two sides of the same fin, the allure of the unknown sea and the fear of its power. Sailors floating in a fragile wooden shell on the vast, inimical ocean tell stories to humanize their surroundings. Someone has to be cast in the role of villain. You have little sympathy for sailors. When you speak, you call storms. If you swim to the surface and sit on a rock and sing to feel the sun on your scales, ships veer into the reef and founder. Your words are strong. They matter. So you are parsimonious with your speech, whispering on those occasions when they come to you asking favors. They need not know how your mouth aches from holding that power in. You give no more thought to your solitude than fish give to the water they swim through. Only sometimes do you remember a hand extended to you from sunlight. It's nearly a decade later when you see her again. Decades mean little when you've been in the shadows for centuries. You recognize her immediately, though she has grown up since you saw her. It's something about the brightness of her eyes. Her tail is pinched with shells of rank, and pearls hang heavy from her neck. Of course she wants something. They always do. There was a sailor, a prince of the land people. He would have drowned, but she saved him. She wants to give up the power of the sea for the faint hope of love, and it is such a faint hope. She's only looked at him, never spoken to him. "I know you can help me," she says, with perfect trust. You are not kind. You don't know how. And if you simply gave her what she asked, she wouldn't trust it. They all know you always demand a price. She doesn't hesitate when you name her voice. You hoped it would dissuade her. You make it worse. Say each step will hurt. Say she must win his love. But she thinks she can, even without speaking to him. She might be right. You hope she is. Unbearable heaviness weights your chest as she swims away, awkward with her legs, but still bright. What might you do with your new voice? It's a rare commodity, tasting as it does of salt water and song and a loving family. You might sing to a sailor without sinking a ship. You are not actually fond of shipwrecks, all evidence aside. You might breathe on the water without summoning a storm. You might say something kind. You might mean it. You are not completely heartless, and you remember the hand reaching to you from sunny water. So when the girl sisters come to you, you make them the knife. "We are afraid," they say. "We want our sister back. Help us bring her back to the ocean. Bring her home." "Give her the knife," you tell them. "If she cannot win his love, let his dying blood wash over her. Her useless legs will become a tail once more, and you will have your sister back." Like their sister, like anyone who's ever come to you, there must be a price. Your hunger for sailors, for death, for everything is widely known. You take their hair, though you have no use for it. Maybe you can make a net of it, or string pearls with it, or weave the world's winds into its knotted length. You hope they get the knife to her. You hope she has the strength to use it against the prince, who doesn't know her to love her. She's been walking on knives for him. Surely he could walk into a knife for her. You put on the voice like a gown and walk amongst the fishing villages. No one knows you to fear you. Your hair is as inky black and tangled as ever, and your footprints still fill with water if you're not paying attention. But your whisper no longer swamps the beach. You ask questions, and people answer, and no one fears the price. Your feet don't hurt, Transformation is part of your nature. A family shares their dinner with you. Whitefish that they caught that morning, cooked in broth over the smoking stove. Their knuckles are scarred from working the nets. In all your centuries, this is new. They feed you because they want to, expecting nothing from you. For the first time, you wonder if the prince might be a sailor like these, with small kindnesses for strangers. It is not in your nature to question, to regret. And yet, you hear of the prince's wedding. No one says that the bride is mute. Far from it. She's well known as a wit in the kingdom of her birth, they say, and she's beautiful as well. Eyes as blue as the sea. You know that the sea is more often green and gray and black, but you say nothing. The girl's sisters have given her the knife by now. You've done as much as you can. It's up to her now. There are villages all up and down the coast where no one knows you and no one fears you. You don't owe her anything. You find yourself in the capital city. The streets are swathed in white flowers, sweet with narcissus and hyacinth, and church bells fill your ears with tintinnabulation. People sing as they walk by, and your new voice swells in your throat, longing to join them, but you aren't ready to celebrate. The sailor prince and his bride have taken a ship into the harbor where the captain will marry them. You make out a tiny figure on the outskirts of the deck, isolated from the festivities, staring at the sea. The sun glints off something in her hand. As you watch, she tosses it into the water. You don't have time to wonder whether it's regret for the girl or relief you feel that the prince, who might be kind, will not die today. The sea surrounds you like an embrace when you jump off the pier. Your powerful tail churns the water and you reach the ship while the opening remarks are still droning on. It's a matter of moments to scale the side of the ship. Barnacles slice your hands and feet, but it's worth a little pain. This is what she's felt every time she's taken a step. Almost everyone is watching the ceremony. The only person to see you ascend like a spider can't speak or scream. She doesn't try. When you reach her, her fear has turned to resignation, and that hurts more than your torn feet. Even when she came to you before, she wasn't afraid. You hold out your hand, dripping with seawater, and she looks at you for a long moment before reaching out to take it. With a wrench of loss for your anonymity, you take your voice, her voice, and give it back. The weight of who you are settles back on you, and your voice rises up in your throat. You give her another gift, too, a piece of your heart, as cold as the Kraken depths where eyeless fish swim, a tiny stain of shadow on her brightness. There are no guarantees, but you hope it will make her own loss hurt less. Before either of you can say anything, you drop to your knees and smear your bloody fingers over her bare feet. There is always a price, but it need not be her price. And take the pain from her footsteps before the memory of guilt can fade. Later you can ask her if she wants her tail back and her home in the sea. She looks over her shoulder as the bride and groom kiss. "He never even knew me," she says. "I'm sorry for all of it." Your voice, your old voice, scrapes in your throat. But it's not the power of the ocean, only regret. "It's all right." She lifts her eyes to meet yours. They're the green gray of waves after a storm. I thought you might want to see the world beyond the sea, you say, knowing it's inadequate. But she smiles. I might, if someone came with me. You smile in return, and if it stretches your lips in unfamiliar ways, no one is watching to see it. All other eyes are on the happy couple. You make your way along the coast, stopping to see all the sights. She does the talking.
I'm Joe Campo. This is In Defense of the End of the World by Leah Sipas. Many call me a visionary genius. To some of you, that is a good thing. Others deem me a reckless madwoman. To some of you, that is a bad thing. The truth is, I am just someone who cares. I believe, I have always believed, that most people care. But we've been trained over centuries to limit our caring to those who share our small segment of the space-time continuum. As a quantum physicist, I have never had that luxury. I know that time exists only in our perception, that, to quote a popular if inexact phrase, everything is happening simultaneously. And ever since my much-reported discovery 5 years ago, often described also inexactly as a time machine, I could no longer pretend that there was nothing I could do about all that pain. If you can stop people from suffering, and you don't, because you've always been told it's impossible, because of theoretical fears regarding the integrity of the space-time continuum, not to become a broken record, but that's also an inexact phrase, or because you've attended one too many seminars on chronological imperialism, what does that make you? My colleague, Dr. Cernoff, would have you believe it makes you smart. His op-ed, published here last month, argues that any action we take in the past merely splits the timeline. According to him, everything I've gone back in time to prevent is still happening. It's just happening somewhere else, in another dimension. Despite Dr. Cernoff's confidence, his theory is no more provable or unprovable than any other theory about time travel. It's gained popular traction because it's a very convenient theory. If nothing you do matters, then you're not required to do anything at all, are you? At least not if you have tenure. I cannot accept Dr. Cernoff's acceptance of suffering on such a massive scale. I cannot acquiesce to the othering of people of the past, the barely veiled assumption that their suffering matters less than ours. I cannot turn my face away, just because there is a risk that intervention will cost us our own privileged lifestyles. Make no mistake about it, I fully understood the problem. If even minor changes in the past can create paradoxes, then major changes, the kind that could save millions from heartache and destruction, would inevitably create them. And though I ran calculations for months, there was no way to predict whether our reality could handle those paradoxes. I chose to take that risk, and I will not apologize for it. Even if current predictions turn out to be correct, if the space-time is unraveling at its edges, if we have at most a few months before those edges reach us, and that is far from certain. Editor's note, this essay was published before the results of the wormhole camera were fully analyzed. I understand something most people do not, that the weight of suffering in the universe far outweighs the amount of happiness it contains. The fact that we are ensconced in a small segment of space-time where that is not true, or
where we perceive it to be untrue, does not change the reality that surrounds us. I understand why you would prefer not to think about this. Your life is pleasant. You enjoy your morning coffee. Your children are healthy. No one who wants you dead has a realistic chance of accomplishing their goal. Sometimes, when the weather is nice, you go for a walk and the sun warms your skin. You enjoy your life. You prefer not to endanger your existence. But your life, the moments you feel yourself living through, are not all there is. The past is not gone. The future is already happening. This we know beyond a shadow of a doubt. Every moment did exist, and does exist, and will exist forever. Your life is an aberration in a universe filled with suffering. So I ask you, can you honestly say the risk I took wasn't worth it? Is the safety of your brief, transitory happiness worth the pain that came before and will inevitably come after? That is all around us right now, if only you could see it. I am posing that question to you now, as I posed it to myself years ago. I answered it as best I could. I can only hope that most of you, if you knew what I know, would answer the same way.
You've been listening to Science Fiction Shorts on North Carolina Reading Service. I'm Kurt Benrood. My team of volunteer readers and I thank you for listening in, and we would love to have you join us next time. Just a quick reminder, this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired, and it is available in podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Once again, that's www.ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. If you are a fan of science fiction and have something to say, we want to hear from you. Live long and prosper.